Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming. As we all read in the headlines and in the papers and on the internet, that shale gas is a very, very, very hot topic. Energy and consumption and resources are foremost on many people's minds. And tonight I'm more than happy to introduce to you one of the foremost specialists on the subject, Professor Piotr Monsas from Stanford and Exponent. And as a brief bio for him, that he's the consulting professor at Stanford University. He's a corporate vice president at Exponent, Failure Analysis and Associates, and chairman of the board and co-founder of U.S. Polish Trade Council. He also serves on the board of directors of the San Francisco Global Trade Council. U.S. Polish Trade Council is a not-for-profit organization providing support in building science and high-technology bridges between Poland and the United States. In the last 2 years, we've had a number of exchanges here in the Bay Area as part of Global Technology Symposium, and the guests that Professor Monsas has invited to come to participate and to experience the Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Bay Area is very, very hopeful for the future for continued exchanges. Dr. Monsas also serves as a consulting professor in the Civil Engineering Department at Stanford University, and his list of more than 100 articles and reports starts in 1976. Numerous lectures, conferences, presentations, and public media interviews is three times as long. So I would now invite Professor Monsas to come forward, and please give him a warm, warm welcome, and let him share all the things that he's found out. He just came back from Poland last night, so this is hot off the presses.
Thank you very much, Karia. Thank you very much to Commonwealth Club for inviting me. Thank you for you being here and finding the time for sharing the talk with me. What I wanted to talk about is the change in approach to the way we produce energy and to the way we use it, and how it influences the econopolitical situation in a region. In this case, the region might be Europe, European Union, or indeed, as I will focus eventually, East Central Europe. Just for reminder, I know that all of you remember all those numbers, but as a reminder, European Union is 492 million people. That's sort of compared to 313 in the United States. The territory is 4.3 million square kilometers, as compared to about twice as much in the United States, 9.8. The European Union consists of 27 countries. The GDP purchase parity of European Union is 14.8 trillion, compared to U.S. 14.7 trillion, very similar economy. The GDP per capita is $32,700 compared to $47,200 in the United States. So they are catching up with us, with larger population, with several states that join European Union that are far behind the founders of European Union. In general, they are becoming a parallel economy to the United States economy, and hopefully, if we continue building bridges between European Union and U.S., we will jointly have critical mass to participate in the world economy. Individually, I seriously doubt. The energy and politics of European Union have number of important points, and I will be addressing those points individually. The first one I would like to address is the diverse interests of member states when it comes to energy and energy politics. That's pretty apparent when you look at energy mix in individual countries. If you take, for instance, France, nuclear energy provides 39% of the energy of France. That compares to 11% for Germany, and as you know, Germany decided to get rid of it. They are going to shut down their nuclear reactors, or so they say, in the emotional outburst after Fukushima. And country like Czech Republic or Poland have Czech Republic has 14, Poland has zero nuclear energy. So there are great differences right there. But then you go further and you look at coal in the energy mix, and you look at Czech Republic is 44% of their energy comes from coal. For France is 5%. Guess how France will vote when it comes to question of CO2 coming from coal, and what will Czech Republic feel about it. Now, when you go to Poland, which gets 61% of its energy from coal, guess how they will feel when it comes to vote on CO2 coming out of coal. Those are very important things to consider. The Guardian had an article a few days ago which said European Union is now under Polish presidency. As you know, they have this style of changing presidency, not by name, but by country. Every 6 months, there is new presidency. And the country that has the presidency at a given moment is trying to have an agenda that is of particular interest to that country and to the countries that work with it. Where Poland obviously has an agenda associated with energy. And the Guardian wrote, is it right to allow Poland to lead European Union into debate on energy where they are totally dependent on coal? Will they be a fair leader to us? So even before the debate started, there is already a debate whether the leader is the right one. So you can see they have some problems to solve there. And then comes natural gas. And on natural gas, the dependence on natural gas is varying too. The Czech Republic is 18%, France is 15%, Germany is 23%, and Poland is moderate 12%. As we go further, you will see that those numbers are not all that we need to know about gas to understand how those countries feel politically about international policies related to gas. Oil, of course, more or less is a reflection of the saturation with cars in given country and the population, because oil nowadays is mainly being consumed in cars. So I mentioned Poland here. And if you look at a mix of the energy source or the prime energy source for individual countries, for European Union, for the 27 countries, coal is about 30%, 29 point something. And for the founding countries, 59%, and for Poland, it's 91% when it comes to electricity production. So you can see that also here are great disparities in the amount of energy that is produced using coal. Hence, the great difficulty in coming to agreement on how to handle the greenhouse gas issue in European Union. There is energy consumption by sector, and that pretty much stays constant for most of the countries. Industry takes about one-third, transportation takes about a little bit less than one-third, household one-fourth, and then you have the other areas. Then comes the issue of energy intensity in individual countries. Energy intensity is how much energy you have to use, BTUs or tons of oil equivalent to produce, let's say, one unit of GDP. And if you consider some sort of a unit, then Germany needs 0.2 of that unit to produce one unit of GDP, and Russia needs 1.4. Canada needs 0.5. Most of the East Central European countries are about 0.6, 0.7. So you can see there is a great disparity between countries that have been working on energy efficiency for a long time, that have used their technology to make their economy more efficient, versus countries that maybe had abundance of energy and used it rather frivolously to produce the same product. Now we talk about the gas consumption in European Union, and if you look at volume now, instead of looking what percentage of their energy use is gas, if we look at the volume that they consume versus other countries in European Union, so you will see very fast that there are really four countries that dictate the gas policy of European Union. It's United Kingdom. They get fair share of their gas from their own sources and from Norway, which is across the street or the strait. Italy, which is mostly Russian gas, with some gas across the Mediterranean from Algeria and North Africa. Germany, which is nearly entirely Russian gas. And France, which is a mixture of Russian gas and Algerian gas, mostly North African gas in terms of piped gas and LNG. The rest of it, in terms of volumes, doesn't count, and volumes means dollars or euros, therefore the power of the other voters is limited. The natural gas use per capita in Europe varies vastly. If you look at country like Netherlands, they use about 2,300 units per capita a year. If you look at country like Germany, that's the median of Europe, is 1,000. And when you look at Poland, the number is about 361. So the numbers vary greatly, and you could go and look at each country and explain it. Sweden, with its huge hydropower and very robust electricity system, they don't use natural gas. And then you have Poland, which is relying on coal, and Poland doesn't have much of its own gas. It produces about 30% of the gas that it uses produces by itself, a little bit less than 30%. And then you have Germany that in the 70s made the decision to move into gas in all domestic use, heating and domestic use. So they are using substantial amount of gas, and because it's a big country, then therefore the median is around the German number. And you have Netherlands, which has, for small country, has unlimited amounts of gas. So they are using gas for everything, including electricity, hence the large number. So we have seen why the member states might have very different views as to the use of gas, as to the policies associated with gas, etc. Now comes the big topic for the entire world, but in European Union is a particular, a popular topic, is the environment, the politics and economy of environment that impact the way that you use energy. Europe has decided that they are going to use by 2020 the change, which is called 20-20-20, which means 20% reduction in green gases versus 1990 level, 20% of total energy will come from renewables, and 20% of energy consumption cut versus business as usual prediction. Business as usual is some sort of calculated curves and say by year 2020 we should be using so and so much energy and we are going to cut it by 20%. You can imagine how difficult all this must be for them considering the collapse of economy and change of the paradigm. If you stop, if you have a collapse of economy, the business as usual doesn't exist anymore. I mean, show me somebody who can explain business as usual in the United States right now. Show me somebody who can name business as usual in Greece, Portugal, or Spain right now. There is no such thing. So I wonder how the European Parliament will deal with this business as usual number. If we look at the European Union electricity by fuel, and we take the coal, which comes both in lignite fire power plants, hard coal fire plants, and natural gas, and we add oil, which is about 4% of their electricity, altogether, fossil fuels provide 53% of European Union electricity. 53% from fossil fuels, which means 53% that produces greenhouse gases that they are trying to deal with in a system that is pretty stable and pretty well established in Europe. Trying to introduce change going up to 20% is not a trivial matter. The greenhouse gases and supplies of environmentally friendly energy, each country has its own greenhouse gas story. And of course, European Union Parliament, if you think we have bureaucracy in Washington, you should watch what's happening in Brussels. Then you would really relax about what's happening in Washington. It's totally incredible. They are trying to regulate everything to the last letter in every technology used, in every aspect of life in European Union. And because of the diversity of interest, diversity of cultures, it's extremely difficult. It's producing monstrous amount of bureaucracy and regulations. Each country, in order to address the greenhouse gases, each country has to develop its own approach to the topic, and so it's each abatement efficiency approach. The goal, however, should be to stimulate the right behaviors through sound economy, not through subsidies, not through interference by regulators, but rather by setting up 30,000 feet policy and then let the locals address the policy. That's something that the European Union is trying to figure out. That's something that particularly East Central Europe is fighting for. They, of course, don't want to be regulated by people who don't understand their specific conditions. Well, abatement by itself is a tough word, but when you start looking at a chart that addresses abatement, then your head really begins to spin, because you have a huge amount of options. You have option number one, you go and you insulate every building so that it doesn't lose any energy. Then you have an option that you start providing energy from the life of the building and from its interaction heat pumps with the ground underneath. The building could be net energy producer. Okay. There is nothing for free, as we know, as Milton Friedman used to say, there is no free lunch. So everything costs some money. So you get the benefit versus the cost, and there are certain technologies and certain approaches that will produce cash for you for being more efficient energy-wise. And there are some technologies that will allow you to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that you produce, but it will cost you the arm and the leg. And you have to decide how much a ton of equivalent CO2 is worth to you or to somebody in Brussels or in Washington. And that's the balance that has to be considered in greenhouse gases abatement. And the greenhouse gases abatement look different for different countries. I just discussed one for Poland, which has some 120 options to it, and one for Russia has maybe 10 options that make sense. It's a very different country, very different economy. And so it cannot be regulated by central committee from any place within the Union. Then we come to the sore point of European Union energy policy, which is the external dependence on energy supply. The energy dependence rate of European Union is increasing at some scary way. If you look at the increase on solid fuels, between 1997 and 2007, there is over 60% increase in dependence. What does it mean? It means that countries which are well off, countries which consider that the economy will continue growing on the path of the 1990s and early 2000s, abandoned their coal mines, stopped their operations, and started importing coal from countries outside of European Union. They couldn't shut down their power plants. They still need the energy. They have the investment in coal-fired power plants, but they abandoned using their own coal because it was environmentally unfriendly. The miners are a pain to deal with politically. It's costly. It's unsafe. It's dirty. Let somebody else do it. We'll just get the ships with the coal. And so you can see how the consequences, how the line of increase in the dependence on imported coal is pretty much straight line with straight slope. And the only reason we see in last few years decline in it is because the economy has crashed on us. What didn't increase much is the dependence on oil. We have been taking a lot of oil, and we continue taking a lot of oil, and it was always coming from outside. So there is no room for more dependence in European Union, which is unlike in the United States. We continue being more and more dependent on foreign oil. Similarly, natural gas. The increase of dependence on natural gas is pretty dramatic, because with the pressure of going into cleaner fuels, there is a move to natural gas. However, the natural gas is coming from abroad, outside of the European Union, mostly from Russia, some from North Africa. Now, if we look at oil and gas exporters, we see that for oil, none of them are within the European Union. So all the oil pretty much has to be brought to European Union. when we look at gas, other than Norway, and their reserves are beginning to decline now, all the gas is coming from outside, from Russia and from Algeria, from Qatar, etc. So if we look at the fossil fuel import dependency, we can see it varies vastly from country to country in the European Union. France imports 98% of its fossil fuels. Poland imports, of its gas, 52% of its fossil fuels. Poland imports 73% of its gas, 32% of its fossil fuels. Czech Republic, natural gas, 99%, but 27% of its fossil fuels. Another country which is heavily relying on coal because they have large deposits of coal and they have well-developed industry, mining industry. Not surprising, the supplies of oil to European Union sort of are all either associated with or controlled by the main nodes in Russia. And the efforts to go around it are ongoing, but quite frankly, not very robust yet. The increase in dependence on natural gas supply. In 2005, imports of natural gas to European Union were about 59%, and the domestic production was 41%. In 2015, the number will be 75% imports, 25% domestic. That's if nothing is changed. Obviously, this is not a very comfortable situation. When I negotiated gas with Russia for a power plant in Poland in 1990s, I was trying to pull the gas down to a price of about $70-$80 per 1,000 cubic meters. Today, Poland is paying $300 per 1,000 cubic meters. That's only 12, 13 years apart since those days. That's a dramatic increase in price. Poland is buying gas on a spot market from Western partners at over $400 per 1,000 cubic meters. That is Russian gas that is sent to Western Europe. They have purchase agreement, and they are reselling it to their partners in the European Union with premium. Okay, so there is a need to do something about it. That's about 3 to 4 times as much per unit of natural gas as we are paying here. 3 to 4 times. But let me tell you that 12 years ago, we were paying 3 times as much for gas as we are paying today. Not we as consumers, but the market was paying. Okay? So there are changes that have happened in the United States. And those changes are associated with the supply and demand law. And the supply and demand works in the United States because we did not link the price of natural gas to the price of oil. Gas has its own price, purely on supply and demand, the same way that we didn't link the price of butter to the price of flour. Okay? There is no reason. Both of them are needed to make a cake. We could have linked them. Okay? We didn't. So you have both independently marketed on supply and demand. In Europe, they have linked oil and gas. And as oil is going through the roof, the same price of getting the gas through the pipeline to the end user, now suddenly the gas costs 3-4 times as much. So that's something that the European Union will have to address. Now, not surprising, some countries have more to say about the energy policies of Europe than others. If you look at the pipeline system and their capacities, Russia has pipeline system that is about equal to the rest of the pipeline systems coming to Europe added together. And the Russian system is growing while the other systems are staying more or less the same, with the exception of Algeria. But this is Algeria before the revolution that we just had. And we don't know what will happen, because we wish them all well with the revolutions, but the revolutions usually have some time of incubation before they can return to steady economical production. So there might be some dramatical changes, even further going to dependence on Russia's supplies. And, you know, fair enough, Putin stated it at that time he was president. As you know, he changes that hat from time to time. He was president at that time and said, what choice can there be between the opportunity to become a leader in economic and social development, a leader in ensuring our national security, and the threat of losing our economic standing, losing our security, and ultimately losing even sovereignty. He's playing on all those well-known notes here. And he explains, we have to be egoistic. We should squeeze every dollar or euro that we can out of the system. Fair enough. This is pretty capitalistic. The last issues of sovereignty and so on is, of course, jingoism. I don't know anybody that wants to attack Russia right now. But an example of this, this was an explanation for the pipeline that was built around countries in Central Europe, between straight between Russia and Germany, pumping gas straight from Russia under the Baltic Sea to Germany, not going through Poland, not going through Belarus or Lithuania. And that deal was cut quietly between then Chancellor of Germany, Schroeder, who is now the chairman of the board of that pipeline, and Gazprom. An outrageous behavior for a chancellor of European Union country. So, European Union has to make few decisions. Has to make a decision related to supplier reliability and diversification. Has to make decisions related to environmental policy, that the policy should be realistic on one hand, and should be clear on the other hand, and has to make some decisions about new technologies, technologies that lead to results in clear physical term and not just to political results. We know our discussion now about this unfortunate solar company into which we sunk $500 million in the United States. So the technologies have to be selected based on their ability to make difference. So the technologies that we should focus on are disruptive technologies. And I have here the example, prime example, which is electric car, and happens to be Tesla here because it's Silicon Valley product. But wherever it is produced, the electric car is a disruptive technology. It allows us to move away from combustion engine towards a production of electricity from fuels that cannot be used in cars. There is the other aspect, the electricity, the density of energy density of batteries today is too low to efficiently fuel trucks and big buses. And so we could move there into natural gas. You know, the Boone Pickens story, he has stood on his soapbox many times and tried to sell his natural gas to the transportation sector of U.S., and that's good. We are using about 14 million barrels of oil a day, 70% of which we are importing. That could be replaced with natural gas, which is produced in the United States or in Canada. That would be a great advantage to our economy and to our international policies. So, let's say we go for that electric car. Where will the electricity come from? It could come from the traditional source, which would be the fossil fuel plant. It could come from nuclear power plant, and it's sort of, it works very well for France. It works for a significant percentage of our energy supplies, 18% or whatever it is. We are building now new power plant, nuclear power plants. We have very well developed a cadre of technical experts. We have very good regulatory system. So for United States, that might be an answer. For countries that don't have the tradition and experience, maybe investing into nuclear power plants is not such a good idea. Hydro, of course, is the dream of everybody, but not everybody has the conditions to put hydro. Hydro comes with a price, too. There is an environmental price to hydro if you put it in the wrong location. Wind, beautiful expectations, but expectations still not fulfilled because the technology of wind turbines is not quite there. The wind turbines are finicky. They are wind intensity dependent. They work only a number of hours a day, and you need to have incredibly, incredibly robust grid to deal with this kind of idiosyncrasies that wind brings to the system. So I would say if you have very strongly developed gas-fired electricity production and you combine it with wind, that could work probably because the gas turbine, you can kick in from zero to full capacity in seconds. That could work with wind. Okay, and then there are some new revolutionary methods. For instance, what about underground coal processing? Let's not mine the coal. Let's not bring it to the surface. Let's process the coal underground. Let's get the energy from it. Let's get the chemical value out of it, but let's not mine the coal to the surface. What about the story that we learn in childhood, that it's very hot in hell? Why don't we go deep enough? Why don't we go deep enough, between 5 to 10 kilometers, and get the heat to the surface? There are various methods. The hot dry rock method that is being tried right now, and that is unsuccessfully being tried because the method is wrong, but maybe we could take different approach. There is an approach which I believe would have worked. Maybe we should sink some money into it and try it. There are, of course, some pipe dreams. There is a team of very prominent engineers in Germany who are working on the so-called solar chimney, where you build a chimney tall enough. They are talking 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet. We don't quite know how to build such a thing yet, but they are analyzing it already. And you heat the air at the air's surface and then it rushes up because it's very cold up there. And on the way in the chimney, you have turbines. The idea is quite dotty because in order to heat the air, you need to have a roof here, which is about 2 kilometers in radius around that that chimney. And when I went to that conference, I said, well, how do you intend to clean that roof? They said, don't disturb the proceedings. So there are a few things that engineers are dreaming of that are maybe not totally practical. Then we have the smart grid. You all heard about smart grid. So far we are hearing about smart grid as some way of reading our electric meter without somebody walking around from home to home. But there's much more to smart grid. And smart grid might increase the efficiency of use of energy. And when we charge our car, when we do our laundry, and when we heat our water. So with smart grid, eventually we'll be able to reach that level of efficiency. Now, a few words about East Central Europe. And if you look at the segment of Europe, not necessarily all of it in European Union, they are vastly different in size countries, different in population. The first number is the area in kilometer square. So Poland is one of the larger ones. Ukraine is about twice Poland. But Germany, being sort of the size of Poland, has twice the population of Poland, etc. So as you can see, there are a lot of differences between those countries that are located in East Central Europe. The energy use in those countries also varies. Poland uses about 5% of all energy of European Union, and some smaller countries obviously use less. But totally, East Central Europe, that is within European Union, uses about 11% of the energy of Europe. The energy intensity of the economy also varies. The economy, centrally planned economy, post-Soviet, was not very attentive to efficiency, and as you can see, they produce much less per unit of energy in terms of GDP than the countries that understood the balance sheet. France, Germany, Luxembourg, they use much less energy per unit of GDP. The natural gas in regional economy. There is a technological demand to reach an economy that is more dependent or uses more natural gas versus other fuels. You need to have exploration production, you need to have transport, pipelines or LNG ports, you need to have storage, you need to have utilization system, and of course safety, environment and efficiency. You need to have laws and economic strategy associated with it. Those countries that did not depend on gas before, or did not use gas extensively before, don't have all those things in place. They have to develop it. And hopefully they develop it so fast enough not to get it imposed by central bureaucracy that will not be consistent with their domestic use and domestic needs. So let's look at the energy challenges of East Central Europe. The challenges are they are heavily dependent on coal. All oil and gas is basically from imports. They have aged electricity generation and distribution system. They have perceived conflict of interest on greenhouse gases, mostly because of the coal dependence. And they have low energy efficiency. But they have some strengths and opportunities. There are about 250 million people within a radius of 1,000 kilometers. Very high density of population. This population is pretty sophisticated, well-educated. Education is still in fashion. People do want to go to university. They have good R&D network system. They have aged electrical generation distribution system. Why is this advantage or opportunity? Because we are moving to smart grid. You can abandon the aged stuff without breaking your heart. You can start with something new. They have large reserves of coal. The coal which was disadvantaged now is an advantage. They can experiment without running themselves into a disaster because they have those reserves. And they are open to new technologies. And Baltic Sea is well known for its wind capacity and it's a relatively shallow sea. So if we reach ever the point where we'll be able to produce electrical energy from wind without subsidies, then Baltic Sea is a good spot. And now comes the big opportunity is the new gas production. And the new gas production is, of course, shale gas mostly, and I'll be talking about it in a moment. But the natural gas in regional economy, let's talk about it for a moment. It needs price definition, which is based on supply and demand. However, it produces jobs, it supports chemical industry, it gives cleaner energy, and gives higher energy efficiency. About jobs, in US, for every new job in the gas sector right now, we are adding about 5 additional jobs of service, equipment suppliers, technology suppliers, and so on. So this is an opportunity also for East Central Europe. There's issue of cost. And now I wanted to talk a little bit about the shale gas. The newspapers are full of stories of shale gas in the United States. The reason that our gas prices have dropped to about 1/3 of what they used to be is to a major degree because of shale gas in the United States. In Europe, they knew that there are certain areas that have the geological formation that are likely to have gas in them. After focusing on it in the last few years, it was clearly identified that Poland is probably the Kuwait of shale gas of Europe. Probably, I say, because it's still in the process of exploring it, of preliminary drilling and finding. The reason it is possible is because United States companies developed the technology of horizontal drilling, lateral drilling, and fracturing of the rock, the so-called fracking. And with those technologies, they were invited to Poland, and they are doing right now exploration, and I just came back from a conference in Poland on that subject. The conference was very prominently American and Canadian, and they are finding gas. They are finding gas. 2 days ago, they found a very substantial gas deposit near Gdańsk. Of course, finding gas in a shale is very different than finding gas in the traditional way. In traditional way, the gas is sitting in very porous media. You drill a hole and the gas starts flowing. So we are talking about a gas flow controlled by milli or at worst micro darcies. Now we are talking about nanodarcies in shale gas. The bubbles are microscopically small. You have to break the bubble and you have to force the gas out and convince it to flow into the pipe and come to the surface. That requires a lot of technology. And that technology is available today, but it's being developed as we are speaking. And there are questions associated with those technologies. And there are, of course, objections. Environmentalists are worried that some of the techniques will influence our groundwater situation. Some other people are worried that it will cause seismic events, earthquakes, etc., etc. Those things need to be addressed. I don't think I have time to get into a shale gas lecture here. But you probably have heard a lot of those lectures so far. The only thing to remember that shale gas is the same gas as any other natural gas. It just sits in very small bubbles. And those bubbles have to be broken into, and the gas has to be pressed out or convinced to come out of those micro pores and be pumped to the surface. Let's say that all this comes true. Let's say that Poland becomes Kuwait of Europe in shale gas. There are other countries also. Hungary has potentially substantial amounts of shale gas. France has some, but France has banned fracking or fracturing of the rocks with explosives. France doesn't need it. I showed you the statistics of France. They are not interested. They are getting all the gas that they need from Algeria. They have 50-year contract. They have good relations there, and they are getting all their electricity from nuclear. So, you know, they can play the high road approach to environmental questions on gas. Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, dependent totally on Russian gas. The gas is not such a big segment in their energy balance, but you still need gas. You cannot live without gas because your chemical industry needs gas, because your cooking at home needs gas, and so on. So you still need gas. And maybe if you move into cargo transportation using gas, you need gas for it. So those countries are pressing for getting their own gas. The very important thing is, what will they do with the money? We know that Middle East has been selling oil now for close to 100 years. This was a mint of gold for them. They were getting money from all over the world. You go there and you say, where is the money? Where is the money? What did they do with this money? Okay? So they did not know how to handle this money. We know that there are books upon books written about the petrodollars, how they are really not productive for the societies that have petroleum. Well, it doesn't have to be so. If you look at Norway, when Norway discovered that they have oil and gas, particularly gas, they took a very different view of it. They established national strategy and imposed national discipline that demanded that the profits that are being drawn from those natural resources are being deposited for the use of future generations, and that the government cannot dip into those funds. Those are sovereign funds. The government cannot suddenly, the president cannot call the parliament, or the parliament call the president and make a deal where they are going to borrow from that social security money. That social security money is off bounds, okay? And Norway is very disciplined about it. And when they start getting into rocky situation in economy, they discuss this rocky situation outside of that money. Okay? They are going through it right now. And there is no way they can use this money for any other purpose than for the purpose that was initially envisioned, for the future growth and stability of the society. So if East Central Europe does the same with its gas, they will be happy and they will be less worried about their retirees, about their schools and universities, because they will have this endowment sitting there. If they do what Middle East has done with their oil, then or Russia is doing with its oil, they will not have much to deliver for a story in 50 years from now. Of course, there are the hazard issues that have to be subject to risk control, and no matter how tight you think your cheese is, and eventually there is a pass that you can weave through individual holes and bring it to a disaster. And so this requires a really intelligent thinking of politicians, economies, and technologies together, not in political way, but in a risk control way, so that the kind of stories that we read sometimes in newspapers about water that comes out of the tap that you can lit up with a match because somebody did shale gas drilling in an irresponsible way, and that has huge impact on future trust in technology, or what happened in Fukushima, that has huge impact on the ability to develop and build a new nuclear power plant. This can be avoided if a responsible approach to risk management is taken. So in conclusion, natural gas is an important element of the regional energy and economy. shale gas in the European Union, including Poland, will be a no-go without a public consensus. Public has to be involved in the decisions. Public has to be educated. Non-conventional gas, that means also shale gas, could be an energy paradigm change for the region. Combination of gas and Baltic wind could provide East Central Europe with enormous amount of reliable and cheap and clean electricity. However, to address this, there will be need for new strategic plan for energy system. You need to take you have a new paradigm, you need to take a new approach. You cannot continue looking at the pipes that you built 20, 50 years ago and say, this is my investment, this is what I will stick to. You have to look into the next 50 years. The East Central European energy system needs to be reconstructed in harmony with the new strategy. And environmental, geologic, and pricing laws have to be consistent with the new energy paradigm. The gas should be used wisely, but it should not be used in the ground for political or emotional reasons. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Monchaus, for that enlightening presentation. We don't have much time, but I think we have time for two or three questions. So if anybody, we have a microphone here. Let me take this over so it will be part of the recording.
Do you have any estimates of a 10-year forecast for wind and natural gas production for Poland?
I don't have the number at the tip of my fingers, but I could provide them with you. And the 10-year production of natural gas will not change. We are in the stage of exploration now. After the exploration is finished, which should be around second half of 2012, then the plans will be drawn for production. Then the production system has to be installed. And with the production system, you have to install the infrastructure that will be collecting the gas. And then at that time, hopefully, also the change in the use of gas will take place that will also take best advantage of the gas being local. Otherwise, the option, the only option would be to pump this gas, clean this gas to very clean level, which is probably unnecessarily expensive, and pump it into the pipelines that are going to Western Europe. That would not be a good policy. So everybody who is seriously engaged in it predicts that this is about 10 years process before we see substantial change in the gas participation in East Central European market coming from shale gas. As for wind, there are some ambitious plans related to wind. Of course, everybody looks at Germany, which went pretty wild on wind. Huge subsidies, of course, huge subsidies. And now is the commitment of closing down their nuclear power plants, at least till the next election or maybe one more election. They have to show that they are building replacement for the nuclear power plants. Germany, after all, is 11% nuclear. To close this overnight with wind or whatever is not a trivial matter. So Germany is heavily vested in wind farms, particularly offshore wind farms. And that experience will be very useful to countries that are bordering on Baltic Sea.
Right here. So you showed the slide and mentioned that there was a maritime pipeline built between Russia and Germany. I'm curious as to if by any chance you know what the cost multiplier was for building a maritime pipeline versus a land-based pipeline, and what part of that might have been right of way. So obviously, technically, it's much, much more expensive, but then there's the real estate issue.
The calculations show that the transportation through that pipeline over life expectancy is somewhere between 2 to 3 times. That providing that the countries through which the pipeline would be passing, if it was passing on land, would stay with the same price agreements with Russia that they have today. And Russia had serious doubts about this, number one. Number two, Russia had some bitter experience with Ukraine, where they tried to settle their dispute with Russia by controlling what flows over the pipe, for a while at least. And so that was the main issue here.
Actually, continuing on the topic of Russia that you just addressed, what, in terms of future prospects, are we looking at, in your estimation, with Russia, because its gas and oil supplies are now such a significant contributor to both its finances and its political influence, as we saw Putin and many of the people in power in Russia now view that as a major political lever, of Russia trying with its large supplies and existing infrastructure to undercut any efforts to develop Eastern European gas and otherwise hamper politically or economically the path that you've laid out?
Thank you very much. That was an excellent question and a sort of softball for me, because a topic of great interest. I read with great interest the European papers, and I see how many stories are being planted into those papers so that the public fears shale gas as the environment-destroying thing. There was a totally irresponsible article in New York Times about shale gas and methane release to atmosphere, and how methane is damaging greenhouse gas, and some professor, not to be named, multiplied that methane by 10, although we know it's multiplied by 3 usually, and all this. That article was immediately copied in European press, and not because European press reads so carefully American press, but there is somebody behind it who is very interested in it. And it's not just the Russians. The Baltic pipeline was built jointly by German gas companies and Gazprom. Some of the supply lines that go from the south to Europe, Russian pipelines, come to companies that are interested in that business. Those companies don't want that business to slow down. It's obvious corporate strategy. So I would say that's capitalism at its best. That's fine. And the response to it will be to deal with your own capitalist weapons. Now, what will Russia do economically when suddenly there will be lesser demand for their gas? I don't know that there will be lesser demand for their gas. It will be just a different price. If Europe wakes up and says, wait a minute, we are willing to pay for your gas X, and if you want 2X, we don't need it, then they will take 1.2X, and they will settle on it. Okay? So there is the difference between monopoly situation and multiple supplier situation that will benefit all of Europe. What will happen to Russian economy? Well, Russian economy will have to wake up. They will have to use their resources more efficiently. They will have to turn their gas and oil into product rather than into bar by selling it into gold. And that will benefit Russia too. Russia needs to get its economy on steady keel. It cannot continue eating natural resources. That's very unstable and very politically very dangerous to the stability of the world.
A As I was going through the long and illustrious list of your publications and talks and whatnot, and seeing the various issues that had presented to you over time, I think it behooves us very much to pay very close attention to what Professor Monsarch has talked about tonight, because he's been very, very timely in all of his publications, his presentations, and we need to take a very, very strong look at the patterns that you've presented to us today and the politics that are involved in that are going to have global repercussions all the way around. So thank you very, very, very much, and I'm sure that you've given us plenty of food for thought.
Thank you.
I can only second that, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California into its second century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.